Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, I'm Ezra from Vampire Weekend, and this is the LSQ Podcast.
You know, some bands, you just love them almost instantly, and that was the deal for me with Vampire Weekend, who I was lucky to be tipped off to early on by some mutual friends in NYC, and my love for them has only grown with each new album as they continue to explore new sonic terrain, including on their brilliant latest one, Only God Was Above Us, which is out now. In this interview, Vampire Weekend frontman Ezra Koenig, who, by the way, is not only one of my mega favorite songwriters, also one of my favorite dudes, talks about his mega favorites. And I guess somewhat unsurprisingly, we have at least a few in common, the Kinks and Belle and Sebastian, among the ones he talks about here. Ezra also shares how his music tastes were shaped by the 50s and 60s pop hits he loved listening to as a kid on his local oldies station, and how that shifted into discovering things like Scott Walker and Neil Young and 90s hip-hop and early aughts Radiohead and a whole eclectic swath of other music, including 21st century favorites like M.I.A. and Lana Del Rey. We also discuss the evolution of Vampire Weekend and how Ezra's view of what the band can be continues to expand. I'm Jenny LSQ. This is episode 105 of the LSQ Podcast.
Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
It is funny to think about, you know, kind of how long now we have been having this kind of conversation. I was trying to remember exactly the where and when of our first interview, which would have been in 2006, I want to say, in the later part of 2006 or early 2007, maybe.
In the lead up to the first album, probably.
In the lead up to the first album, yeah.
I would think so, yeah.
I want to say I remember sitting outside in some weird area between buildings in Midtown with like my tape recorder or something, making you talk about influences back then. And here we are doing it again.
Yeah, that sounds familiar, actually. I have this memory of being in charge of the Vampire Weekend minivan, which is what we toured in the early days. And yeah, that could have been the first album, because I have this memory, a very New York memory of like, waking up in my girlfriend's apartment, which was Upper West Side, and looking and being like, oh, I got to go to this interview with Jenny LSQ in about 2 hours. Okay, so I know I have to move the car because it was whatever Tuesday morning. And I was like, got to move the car and then, jump in the shower and take the subway to the meeting. And then 2 hours later, I'm like in the car. I just remember it was like one of those insane days where I could not find parking. And maybe because it was those early days, I wasn't about to like shell out $40 or whatever. So I just kind of remember this like psycho feeling of like, oh my God, how long have I been in this car? Like, look, you know, I feel like I probably like rolled up, like hadn't taken a shower, like all like sweating and stressed out.
That's what you do to yourself. I can relate so hard. The number of hours I spent stressing myself out by deciding to take the car somewhere and then you have the guilt and like self-resentment. You're just like, I put myself through this.
It's so luck of the draw. You could have like the greatest parking day of your life or hours go by. And
yeah, it's fucked up. But it was long enough ago that I feel like forgive me if I forget, some territory we trod back in the day about your individual, just like early days before you met those guys and before college, of getting in touch with kind of your creative self. Was songwriting a thing for you as a teenager or as a kid before you started the band?
Yeah, I can remember the first song I wrote, because I know there's a recording of it somewhere. I know that my mom still has, I wrote the sheet music. How old would I have been? I don't know, 10 or 11 or something. And I wrote this song called Bad Birthday Party. It was kind of a 50s song. And I had a little 70s like silver dictaphone type thing, tape recorder. And I would like to sit at the piano and like write and record songs. So that was the first time I had that real feeling of, oh, right, you can write songs and put them together. And I even remember like playing the tape at school once. Maybe I was like proud of a song or something. So yeah, that was at a pretty young age. I was interested in songwriting in some sense.
Who did you think you were emulating as a kid at that point?
Well, I've always been a little bit old-fashioned, I think, in my taste, because I remember the chord progression. It was like the classic 50s chord progression. It had like that kind of 50s vibe. And I remember I don't even know who would have gotten these from me, my parents or a family friend. I had a handful of tapes that I would listen to on my little Walkman. And I had a bunch that were the Billboard. They made a series. Billboard would do the top 10 hits of 1957, top 10 hits of 1961. And also, you know, growing up in northern New Jersey, there was WCBS-FM New York with Cousin Brucey.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder if now, if they still have that oldies station. Now they probably play like early Ariana Grande are the oldies they play. But back then it was like pure 50s, like nothing past 1965. They weren't even playing like the Rolling Stones. So I remember between these Billboard tapes and WCBS FM, I love stuff like Earth Angel by the Penguins and, you know, Last Kiss. I was probably like one of the few 13-year-olds when Pearl Jam came out with their cover of Last Kiss. I was like, doesn't touch the original, because I was so familiar with it. We were out on a date in my daddy's car. And like Leader of the Pack. I don't know. Like, I knew that music like so well. I listened to it all the time. So I guess those are my early influences, like doo-wop. And
you like to listen to that on your own, on your Walkman? Or was that like just, you know, did your parents had it on? Because, well, your parents had more kind of contemporary to themselves sort of taste in music back then.
And also my parents would never play a ton of music around the house. They had great records. And they had both, between the two of them, my mom was very into like classical music and stuff. And my dad had great taste in like pop music. And he was still buying punk records and early hip hop. So there was plenty of that stuff in the house, and that played a role later. But no, this was music that I just like, I really connected with. Yeah, that late 50s, early 60s music. Like, I also remember, what's it called? Because I want pop, a girl to call my home. I want a dream lover. Is it called Dream Lover?
Yeah.
I don't have to dream alone. I remember like waiting to hear that on WCBS FM, like as if it was like a contemporary song. I just like found that song very powerful. Also like Lollipop.
Oh yeah.
I guess all kids like that, because sometimes I play it for my kid. And as soon as you're bum, 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 you know, with all the different voices building the chord, everybody's struck by it. Those are my early influences.
Yeah, I mean, so when you think back to like just singing along with the CBS FM stuff, this is before you had tried writing a song, like, did you know in some childlike intrinsic way, like, I love music, or I love, you know, were you singing along? Like, when did you first start to make it a priority and know that it was something important to you?
I definitely always liked music, but then by the same token, I do have a distinct memory of it somewhere in there, age 10 or 11, because I was really into comic books. I was really into X-Men at that time. And I have this memory of, for my birthday, my parents giving me, you know, a medium-sized box for my birthday present, and me thinking, if this is loaded with X-Men comics, I'm going to be the happiest boy on earth. And then I opened it, and it was an Iowa CD cassette boombox. And I remember being very crestfallen and feeling a little bit like, so I liked music, but I don't know. I know. even at that time, I just kind of remember like I liked music, but I was like, what the fuck am I going to do with this? Like, and then, of course, I was so glad I had it within a year or something. So, yeah, I always liked music and I liked the idea of being a musician. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how like driven I was. I think I've been always been lucky to be around slightly more driven people, like people who even when I was a kid, I'd hang out with one of my oldest friends, Wes Miles, and a bunch of guys, even in our small town in New Jersey, which was not particularly artsy or something. We still found like a crew of kids who were pretty interested in music and making music. But also at some point, Wes's dad had like an ADAT machine in the basement. So there's a lot of like, oh, we should go use that. So I don't know. I've just always been lucky that I was like around people who are like, let's go record. Because I wonder, would I have pushed myself enough if it had just been me, you know?
Yeah, well, so after you did, after that first song that you're talking about that you wrote, like, yeah, was it just a sort of intermittent habit, like, you know, trying to write a song or trying to until you were doing it in a band?
Yeah, I mean, at some point I got a guitar, so I must have asked for a guitar for my birthday. And then when people start having bands, like fifth or sixth grade, you know? So then I kind of remember being in bands, like going over to somebody's house and like, oh, that guy's got a bass now. He got a bass for Christmas. And, you know, but there was, I know, I'm pretty sure it was in seventh grade is when me and Wes and a couple other kids like really had a band and we had a performance. Some, I can't remember how this stuff came about, but we were booked to perform at our seventh grade graduation and we did a mini set and we played one by U2. Because Wes's older brother's like a massive U2 fan. I mean, I love that song now, but I kind of remember the time like listening to it, just being like, I was a tiny bit too young for it, but I was like, all right, let's try this. Did you come here to play Jesus to the lepers in your head? It's just like, what? It was a little bit above my pay grade at that moment, but he picked that. And then somebody else picked Sunshine of Your Love because that was like, like a early, easy riff to learn. But then there was one original, which I'd written that was called The Beast from the Sea. At that point, I was starting to get pretty interested in surf music. You know, this big surf music revival in the 90s. So I wrote this kind of surfy punk song, The Beast from the Sea. Looking back on it, it was clearly very influenced by Rock Lobster, by the B-52s, because it was like about some kind of a monster incident at the beach. But I remember we played it and I remember being like kind of like, oh, this is cool. And there's like a part that had like gang vocals where it's dun 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 the beast, dun 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 the beast, dun 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 the beast. And like everybody's yelling. I was like, beat the beast from the sea. So that like felt like, I don't know, getting older, having a guitar, playing with other people, getting interested in like styles, I guess. And then after that, from seventh grade on, Wes and I always had bands with different friends of ours. And then by high school, you know, we had this group of people who were called the Sophisticuffs, and we were recording all the time. So that was great too. It wasn't just a band. We could listen back to these recordings we made and we would mess around with old keyboards. And I don't know, I feel like back then we'd always see somebody like throwing out one of these like weird old organs, you know, from the late 60s, and they would have cool drum machine sounds. So then after that, we were always recording and always writing songs, and we'd go play little shows like church basements and stuff like that. So there's something to kind of work towards.
Yeah, I mean, was it easy for you to get up and perform, or did it feel, yeah, was that something you had to get used to?
It was pretty easy. I mean, there have been many times in my life where I was beset by anxiety and, you know, fear of what people think. So I'm not trying to say that I haven't had that experience that many of us have had. But for whatever reason, I never cared about getting up on stage in front of the mic. And I would play all these songs and the lyrics weren't written. I'd just get up there and be like, because she told me and I don't know why you... I would just like make stuff up. I don't know. I never... Maybe because we were playing in a church basement. Maybe even back then I had some sense of perspective. Like, we're playing for 15 kids in a church basement. I'm not I'm not too worried.
I mean, it sounds like from the sea monster, which also I just have to say, a monster on a beach feels very Vampire Weekend to me anyway. It feels like I'm just like, these themes have persisted. It sort of feels...
It's true. I mean, vampires in Cape Cod, like...
Exactly.
The blueprint was there, man.
I am also sort of curious, and I like if musically there is anything in there, like if I heard that song, would I be like, I can hear the V Dubs in there? It's a little prehistoric V Dubs vibe.
I think you would definitely see. Well, of course, I can think of, you know, later demos that probably have a little more Vampire Weekend energy. But when I think back to whatever being in middle school, I think what you would find is some of my like guitar playing, like playing simple touch of reverb, clean guitar lines. There is stuff like that. Because I love surf music, and because Wes's dad, shout out to Doug Miles, had a Fender Twin amp with a built-in reverb, you'd hear these kind of clean little bit of reverb guitar lines, especially playing on the high strings. So that 100% has some connection to like the early Vampire Weekend guitar sound.
And also the idea of having a song, one of the early songs you remember was based on a story, and that kind of songwriting as a storytelling, which, you know, when you mentioned that 50s, 60s classic stuff, you know, that's one of the great features of some of those classic songs, is that there's more of a story to it than some modern pop song fare has. I wonder, yeah, how important it is to you to have that, a larger storytelling mechanism as a vehicle for songwriting.
Well, I definitely felt like the band needed a kind of a narrative or a vibe. You know, when by the time Vampire Weekend started in college, I'd been doing all sorts of other stuff. I hadn't been in a band per se. I'd had like a rap group. I was making beats. I was like coming up with kooky ideas. So to get back into a band format, it felt, and also I'd had enough experiences like trying to jam with people before I found my crew to realize like, God, I hate the kind of like Guitar Center universe of like, I don't know how to put it, but just like rock music. And I just had feeling like I didn't speak the same language as people. So to start a band again, I felt like it had to have a look or an aesthetic. So, you know, I wrote this manifesto early on that was about what's going to be kind of this collegiate preppy band. It's also the time where I was getting very interested in just preppy clothes and no t-shirts on stage and no distortion in the guitar. So by that point, I saw why a band also had to be kind of like a project and not just he's the best drummer in Northern New Jersey and he wants to come rock out with you in the garage. Like I'd been around some of that stuff and I just like didn't understand it. So I saw how maybe not a story per se, but, you know, a concept was useful. And then in terms of the songs, I guess, yeah, there is something about some of those songs. Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa has like a bit of like a story in it, or Walcott, certainly coming from this backyard movie we made. So, yeah, I think there's a bit of that slightly old-fashioned thing in there.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if in any way it carries through other Vampire Weekend albums and this new album as well, the idea that, and it's not so much that individual songs all tell a story, but that you at the looking down on it as the omniscient narrator can see a story that this is pieces of, you know what I mean? As a way of organizing it in your own head, that these are all part of the same kind of larger story. Like, does it feel like Only God Was Above Us, that the songs all connect to kind of a larger story / larger themes?
Definitely. Although now, as I get older, I increasingly think of that, these larger themes, as being somewhat out of my hands. You know, of course, you have things on your mind. You take a snapshot of your worldview in a three-year period that's going to have something to do with a record. But I've also noticed sometimes I need space to say I have this gut feeling these songs go together, and then just later on I'll be listening to them, playing them for people, rehearsing them, and I'll have a realization like, oh, that makes a lot of sense, that how that song moves into that song. And I just realized some, so it doesn't always come from me, you know, songs are kind of their own thing, and they want to come into the world, I think, so they come into it via us, but you know, you're not always totally in control of it. And actually, when you were saying that, it also made me think. I remember too being in high school when I was, you know, fully a music obsessive and buying old records and listening to the radio and watching MTV or whatever I could, you know, talking with people about music. And some year in English class, I think a lot of people do this, you had to read Dubliners by James Joyce. And I just remember being like, oh, this, okay. And probably even just having the teacher being like, well, this is a really important book of short stories. And it's about, he's kind of looking around the city and looking at different stories. And, you know, there's old people and there's young people and there's moments of a child experiencing like embarrassment for the first time. And there's like an old person having their own experience. And it ends with this like epic novella called The Dead. Everything about, as I was getting so into like albums, to also be forced to read that, because I just remember being like, oh yeah, right, this is like an album, it's going into different characters, but it's united by obviously a sensibility and a sense of place. Classic That's What Only God Was Above Us is like, ending with like the intense long song. That's pretty Dubliners.
And what, so when you were in this phase, the Dubliners era, like, so what was the music you were most obsessed with? Is that like Radiohead times? Is that Wu-Tang Clan? What's that? What's going on there?
I mean, I was definitely into all that stuff, all the classic 90s music. The things that jump out to me that were like particularly meaningful to me, I remember getting super into the Kinks, you know, again, being a touch old fashioned, and hearing Something Else and Waterloo Sunset. My dad had some compilation, and I kind of remember him saying, and I guess I've been very influenced. I guess everybody is. And he played me Waterloo Sunset. And, you know, it's funny when I have conversations like this, talking about growing up with music, I have such clear memories of when people in my life told me that they loved a song. Like, that was always so meaningful to me. Like, I remember, you know, like a girl I grew up with and hanging out at her house when we were like 14 or something. And I don't know, she loved like a Van Morrison song. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I don't know. I really clocked it. I was like, oh, you love this song in particular. Like, you're playing it over and over again. And that person loves something. I don't know. I love that, to kind of see. I can still recall some of these things so clearly. I remember like, he loved that song and he told me he loved that song and he wanted to play it for me. And so I have a lot of memories like that. And of course, with your parents, you know, that at a young age, that can be extremely meaningful. So I remember my dad saying, like, you want to hear a good song? You want to hear, like, good songwriting? This is a Waterloo Sunset. And I probably knew, you know, You Really Got Me and early Kink stuff. So that was, like, meaningful to me, as I recall. That I was like, oh, this is interesting. This song means something to my dad. He's impressed by the songwriting. And then I love that song. And then eventually I was curious, well, what album was this on? So I got Something Else, and I got Village Green Preservation Society. And I was very interested in, you know, Ray Davies and also Dave Davies. Did they say Davis in England? I've never been sure about that.
Oh, shit. I don't know. I hope that
it's one of those like Bowie things.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever. We say Davies here.
We say Davies here. Yeah. I mean, similarly, that album, Something Else by the Kinks, which I listen to that album. Like, I was just listening to it the other day. It's still in heavy rotation.
It's a great album. And also, it totally has that Dubliners energy of, I mean, track one is David Watts, right? So it just starts out with like a full name, which I love. I mean, that's pretty, yeah, like Vampire. We got a lot of name songs. Walcott, Bryn, Diane Young, you name it. But just, I remember that starting out like talking about this boy David Watts that all the other kids like want to be like, wish I could be like David Watts. Like, even that, because, you know, most songs are fall under a handful of categories: heartbreak, falling in love, having a good time, whatever. And of course you can slice those topics a million different ways, but there's something so specific about a song about being a kid and essentially being jealous of somebody else. I wish I could be like David Watts. Like, he just has some kind of riz. I want to be like David Watts. And then you get into like Death of a Clown, kind of depressing, and then Waterloo Sunset. And you really have that same feeling of like, these are snapshots of very different types of people, maybe united because they live in the same place at the same moment or something like that. And Village Green Preservation Society, the exact same thing. Like, that or yeah, do you remember Walter? It's like, I love that stuff. Just like
that, I fucking love that song. But also on something else, Two Sisters, another great story.
Oh yeah, no, right. Or that's probably the best one. Thanks for reminding me of that. And I love that is harpsichord, which I loved. And yeah, that was actually probably my favorite song when I first got into that album. She was so jealous of her sister and her smart young friends. Yeah, it's like truly a bunch of short stories on that album.
Yeah, and you're right, David Watts, because David Watts opens with that fa 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 fa, and you're like, what a great start to an album, I'm in.
Yeah.
And but tell me about your journey a little bit with Radiohead. I'd love to hear a little bit of that saga.
Let me think. I did not really clock OK Computer coming out. I was 13, I think, when that came out. I don't know what I was thinking about when I was 13. I wasn't. Also, I didn't have MTV at my house. I loved MTV, but we just didn't have it at my house. So I watched it at other people's houses. So like, I wasn't like super, super tuned in that era. So I remember, I mean, I'm sure I knew the song Creep on hearing that on the radio, and I'm sure I knew Karma Police. But the first album I remember coming out was Kid A. So that was kind of interesting because I remember seeing people like debate it and seeing people be kind of like disappointed. And I kind of remember listening to my friend's CD copy on headphones and like really trying to take it in. So that was the first album I really got into. And then I went backwards to OK Computer. But yeah, that Kid A into Amnesiac era was very exciting because I saw them at the Garden. And first of all, I remember I learned a lot from those albums because they went and did press and talk about their influences. And they kept talking about Can, Tago, Mago. And I was like, I got to hear this. And I bought that at Borders bookstore in like Paramus or something. But yeah, those albums, and in some ways, actually Amnesiac, if I really had to zero in on the Radiohead album, that hit me at the right moment where I was just like so there when it came out, so dialed in. It would be Amnesiac, which people would probably put it as a distant third if you're talking about OK Computer, Kid A, and Amnesiac. But there's something about that album. I mean, I know Radiohead fans love that album, but it obviously couldn't possibly have made as much noise as Kid A because it was the next album. But I remember finding that album really fascinating and listening to Knives Out and Pyramid Song and stuff. That like that's the moment where I feel like I was super in tune with Radiohead. And then of course I've always kept an ear out for them, but that was my Radiohead high point, Amnesiac.
And Radiohead were sort of a bonding moment for you and Bayo at least or something early on, right? Yeah.
Yeah, no, and Rostam was a Radiohead fan. I guess everybody was. And I liked that. I mean, this might be kind of obvious to say, but it was interesting for somebody kind of getting into music and having bands and stuff because they also made you realize, oh, you could be in a band and you like all sorts of different music and you can synthesize that in some way into what you want to do. Like, I remember driving around. I mean, at this point, I'm more like probably 16 or 17. And I remember driving around with friends in New Jersey and listening to like Boards of Canada. And like at that point, we're probably getting more like sophisticated with our taste. And we would check out like Warp Records stuff or kind of vibey stuff like that. So I kind of, there's something interesting about knowing, okay, then the Radiohead world is not a million miles away from this, but they're taking some of these ideas into what they do. So I think the Radiohead as a kind of synthesizer, you know, not a keyboard, but like a entity that creates synthesis was very interesting and like influential to me at that time. Be like, oh, because I also liked electronic music and I liked hip hop and stuff like that. But they showed that there was like a lot of room within the kind of classic, perhaps old fashioned band format to like try new stuff.
Has it been harder for music to hit you in that way since you've been making music, like since you've been making albums on your own, like that kind of, because what I wanted to ask was, after Radiohead, what are there other instances where something hit you that intensely, where an artist like blew your mind and you were like, okay, now I'm in?
You know, I think my high point of being interested in new music was probably age 16 or 17. I remember specifically towards the end of high school, maybe I burned a CD or like Hank driving around with Wes, and we were listening to like, you know, Strokes' first album, early Radiohead. I remember I really liked the song Romeo by Basement Jaxx. You keep on giving me the hold up. I love that. We loved Daft Punk, and particularly what's the song that has like an Eddie Van Halen guitar solo? Is it Aerodynamic or something? We just like loved it. It's like dang it, dang it, dang it, dang it, dang it, dang. This like arpeggio solo. So that was probably the high point where I was like just so in, and like I loved Matador Records. I even finagled an internship there when I was in high school, and just remember like I was like so in. I was like, I'm interested in literally everything you're putting out. I was like, I mean, I loved Belle and Sebastian. That Belle and Sebastian's huge for me, but everything. I was like, Mogwai, like check it out. Stephen Malkmus solo, why not? I'll give it a try. You know, like I was just like whatever they were putting out in that era. I was Solex, people Solex, that was dope. I was just like early Cat Power. Like me and my were just like just in. So that was the most engaged I felt in it, with contemporary music. And like I said, there's always been like a slightly old-fashioned part of me. Like when I think about going to college, I think I got even more backwards looking. That's when I started getting interested in like Neil Young. I remember being in college and hearing like A Man Needs a Maid and being like, wait, what? What is this? This is so crazy. This music's insane. And then I was like listening to Leonard Cohen and Scott Walker, and that was kind of really blowing my mind. And yeah, so, you know, by college, I was probably like a tiny bit of a hater, and that's never left me, where it's just kind of like, I can't be bothered with new music. And of course, I don't know. Let me see. What times when I was legitimately excited by something? When I think of in the 21st century, when I was like firmly into adulthood and past high school era, when I can think of a handful of times where I was just immediately so drawn to something. One was when MIA first came out. I remember I bought I don't know if it was her first single, but I remember like I was like dug deep to like. I was like so interested in it. I think it was Galang or something. And I remember getting this like kind of white label thing. And I even remember like I sent her a message or something, 'cause at the time I was into making these like spray paint Lacoste shirts. And I remember being like, can I send you a shirt? And she was like, sure. I don't know what that would have been on. I don't even think that was MySpace yet. It might have just been on her website. So I just remember being very like excited about her when she first came out. I was in college by then. And then I don't know, this also might seem kind of like obvious, but and I don't want to say the last time, this makes me sound like too much of a hater, but one time I can recall in the past 15 years where I heard a song by somebody for the first time and I was instantly kind of like I felt it so hard and it was shook was Video Games by Lana Del Rey. It's because I still whatever that was that 2009, 2011?
Like a
I
difference.
distinctly remember that and being like, and just again, one song and probably that video too, which I think she edited herself, and just being like, what is this? This is so on another level. Those are a couple that jump out in the 21st century.
How would you say your sort of outlook for what the band can be has changed the most since it started, at the risk of asking too lofty a question? I mean, when you were beginning the band, were you even thinking like, oh, I'm starting my career now, I'm going to do this for a living?
I think I was kind of hoping, but I don't know. That was an intense time because it was a senior year of college, and I was starting to realize like, oh, I've been in a little cocoon for a few years, because I distinctly remember, I remember hearing a lot about people, because of course Columbia, Ivy League school, I think the biggest major is economics, and of course you get many people who go into finance or law or something corporate. So I remember feeling like I just like barely made it through college. I wasn't like I was a very good student in high school, you know, but I was classic by the time I get to college, be like, I don't know, I guess I'll major in English. I wasn't a particularly passionate student. I loved some of my classes, but you know, I was just okay. And then kind of being like, all right, college is ending. And then realizing, hearing from my parents, like, oh, well, you're not going to have health insurance anymore, because I received health insurance through my dad's labor union. Shout out to IATSE. and they covered until you're done with college or until you're 22 or something. And I'd be like, oh, what? Okay. It's just like something I never thought of as, you know, blissfully privileged enough to think about until then. And then meanwhile, I'm hearing about all these people going into finance and stuff. And I remember just distinctly being like, hearing people being like, you know, they get a $10,000 signing bonus. Like me, and I'm thinking, like, wait, what does that mean? It's like, no, well, they get like, as soon as they start their job, they get a check for $10,000. I just remember at the time being like, what? And I just remember starting to be like, wait a second, am I an idiot? What's happening? Like, was I supposed to major in economics? Did, like, oh my God. So I remember at the time having a lot of anxiety, and I, you know, desperately tried to figure out something to do. I became a teacher in Brooklyn, my one real job, did that for a year. So that's all to say that when I think about ideas like career and art and money, I just associate that time with like confusion above all. I felt like I was got doused in like a sudden dose of realism. So did I think the band was going to like become a full-time job or something? I don't know. I was like taking in a lot of information at once then. I knew I liked the band and I knew that it could be cool, but I don't know if I had a sense of like, how far can this go? You know, I learned within 2 years, I learned quite a bit about like the music industry and what's possible. But in those early days, I mostly was just kind of like, well, this could be like a fun thing to do. And also it was so DIY that, you know, we're making the album totally on our own, recording in Rostam's room. Maybe we did a little bit of drums in Juan's basement, which, you know, became a Pitchfork show. But, you know, it just didn't, I don't know it's really hard to recall what I thought of in terms of like career.
And when you think about it now, though, when you sort of zoom out and have these moments, you know, in the months leading up to an album coming out, when you're finishing it and sort of assessing, like, what are your hopes for where Vampire Weekend kind of sits?
Well, I can say one thing in terms of what is the band, I can say I had a really good feeling lately, more than lately, like, you know, last few years or more, just in terms of like, so you can imagine when you start a band, I'd been in enough bands, you know, as discussed, by the time I'm 21, when the band started, I'd been in enough bands that I knew a couple of things. One is bands can't be democracies because they needed a direction. So I had enough insight from my youth to say to everybody else in the band, I want to start this band. Here's my concept. But, you know, I was open to other people's ideas, and there were a lot of great ideas. But the two things I knew, I said, I want to be the lead singer, because it's just such a nightmare situation where every time you start working on something, if everybody's looking around, well, maybe I could sing this one. You know, like, I have an idea. I've just seen it too many times where it gets weird. And it's like, well, and of course you look in rock history and people are like, well, I only got to sing two songs in this album. It's like, I just had a sense that wasn't what Vampire Weekend was supposed to be. So I wanted to carve that out and say, in this band, I have a vision that I'm the singer. I'm not saying I need to write all the songs, but I do need to be in charge of choosing all the songs. That was also very important to me because, which again, that's a lot to ask a bunch of other 21-year-olds, but I remember saying to myself, like, I believe I have enough vision for this band that I know it's not all about me. And obviously it's never been all about me. And, you know, it's incredibly lucky that, you know, somebody like Rostam from the early days as a producer and a writer, you know, there's so much there. But I did know that when the band started, I needed to, yeah, have the be able to choose the songs, because otherwise I felt like the vision wouldn't be there. So, you know, on a song like on the first album or something, you know, like Campus started as this demo that Rostam made, had this strings and it was a bit slower, but it had like the vast, vast majority of the ideas. I added a handful of lyrics or something. And then of course we turned it into the punky Vampire Weekend version with everybody playing it. But like when he threw that song out there, maybe this could be something. I was like, yes, yes, it could. I knew it. I knew it. I knew that song belonged on the album just as much as ones that I'd been tinkering with, like Oxford Comma or Walcott or whatever. So anyway, I had this sense of like, yes, we all belong together in some sense in this moment as a band. And if if I can have those things, I really think we can have the best of both worlds. But again, in terms of that, my demand to have some degree of leadership, some degree of decision making, as soon as the first album was done, and so many great ideas came out of the four of us in a room. And yet I also knew when sometimes we try to jam on another song, such as there's a song I wrote when I was 20, or let's say I wrote the vast majority of, I wrote the verses in the chorus called Hannah Hunt. And it was this kind of country song. And I had this feeling this could be good for this band. And yet early Vampire Weekend days, we'd start jamming on it in the room and I just wanted to die. I was just like, I thought the song was good. It sounds terrible. Now, also, I'm learning as all this is happening that not every song can be brought to a group of people in a practice space in Midtown and start sounding good. So sometimes, well, that song was obviously meant to be mostly very quiet, very much a studio kind of recording. So anyway, I'm starting to realize like there's things that I want to accomplish that don't seem to go down well when it's four people bashing away in a room, even though that's what led to A-Punk, still our biggest song. But I knew that didn't always work. And I knew I had some ideas. And by the same token, sometimes Rostin would send me pieces of music that he made. They're little electronic things or something. And I was like, I know that this feels right too, but maybe we need time to work on this together. So as early as Contra, it became a thing where it's like, all right, we're not always all going to be in the studio. And so that's right there, this first kind of, what would you say?
An inflection point, yeah.
Inflection point, a little schism. And, you know, that requires, again, how old are we then? 23, 24, a little bit of like, oh, well, I guess, you know, now we've had some success running a business. Okay, well, maybe people had different expectations about what things are going to look like. So on an album like Contra, I had a vision and I was so impressed by, let's say, like the original White Sky synth part that Rostam did, or on a song like Taxi Cab, which was kind of based on this old electronic thing. I did. He took that and made like a beat out of it. And I was kind of feeling like, oh yeah, this is cool. This doesn't need live drums. So for the first time, there's that little inflection point where it's like, I love Cousins. That song only came out of a soundcheck kind of thing. I'd always play this, my banana riff and then CT. And I was like, I know I like that. That feels like Vampire Weekend, but also know Taxi Cab feels like Vampire Weekend. So, you know, again, trying to figure out these different modes. And so Contra already, there's more of that studio project vibe. And then by Modern Vampires, even more of that studio project vibe. And on top of that, we're collaborating with a new person, and it's a producer. It's not another musician. It's a producer, Ariel. And so by then, that album, zero songs began in soundcheck. Zero songs began in a practice room. That doesn't mean that there's not contributions or that not everybody played on it in some sense. But totally, that did not come out of those spaces. And then, you know, we have a lineup change, Father of the Bride, especially working on that album. Not only were we in this kind of delicate place where the band had changed, but the indie rock moment that we were been a part of had so clearly ended. The exciting ways of making music seemed very distant from those early practice space days. And again, I've built this close relationship with Ariel, so we're working closely and we're starting to occasionally get some little Steely Dan, like, oh, do you know anybody who can play like a fretless bass? Like, oh yeah, there's this dude who, like, you know, towards the James Taylor. And I'm like, all right, let's try it. By that point, we'd been down enough roads that it wasn't hard to talk with CT Urbeo about like, okay, we got this guy doing this or that guy doing that. It still felt like Vampire Weekend, but we, you know, we're still delicately trying to figure it out. I had so much gratitude that they continued to let me kind of do my thing. And at that point, I'm looking at Ariel like, well, like, you're almost in the band, but, you know, we have this kind of partnership. But I'll tell you, the moment when I really started to feel like a real sense of like, ah, relief is the Father of the Bride tour, because that's when there finally felt like this proof of concept, which was like Vampire Weekend can be just about anything in the studio. It can be the original members bashing on their instruments. It can be me and the guy who plays bass with James Taylor. You know, it can be almost anything. It can be have an electronic basis. It could be made totally on the computer. It could be made acoustically, whatever. It could be made with a sample. It could be another person singing. It could be Steve Lacy jumping in, you know, whatever. That had been pushed about as far as it could be pushed. And I always believed this would be the case, but still, you need proof of concept. But can me, Chris, and Chris come back, even adding new people? Because it was I wanted to have my, you know, Grateful Dead lineup. I wanted the two drummers, all that stuff. Can we do that? And somehow everybody plays a role and feels like part of this thing, and the history matters, all that stuff. And the answer was yes. It really felt good. And, you know, I felt like on that album, I don't know, I had this like superstition or something where I was like, I should go represent the music and go. I also felt like such an awkward time. Like I might have to go take a few hits, but I should go be like the face of this. And then our big band should be the face of the live show. Whereas moving into this album, me, CT, and Bayo as like a unit, which has always been a friendship and a camaraderie, it felt like more like, okay, well, this reflects this album a bit more. And of course, like, you know, to be honest, again, what the vast majority of this album that is me and Ariel sitting in front of a computer. But then there's also a good proof of concept where like me and CT wrote a song together. And in a way, it's the first time that's been on a Vampire Weekend album. CT's contributed in many huge ways. It was his idea to go, hey, on A-Punk. I often think, what if he hadn't suggested that? I wouldn't be sitting here right now, you know? But anyway, this is the first time he and I had ever sat down and tried to write a song together, but it was a long time ago. And I picked it back up and I worked on it with Ariel, and then like finally it got finished for that's Gen X Cops. So I don't know. We're at this interesting place now where we've been down so many roads. I can speak for myself and say, are there times when, you know, I've approached a song or, you know, a little bit like a solo artist where it's kind of like, yeah, I'm going to do this how I want to do it many, many times. And are there times when I've wondered, well, if I'm approaching a song that way and, you know, not all the original members play on it, you know, what does that mean for the band? Does that mean the band's not a meaningful unit? And I know that the answer is no, the band is a meaningful unit. And when I think now about like various forks in the road, when maybe things were weird or tense, or I could have gone solo, or the band could have been cleaved into different units or something, I just kind of think like, no, there's such a continuity between these records. They're always going to be different. Like, you know, the amazing contributions Rostam had in the beginning. Like, there's even with different, the amazing contributions that all sorts of people had on Father Bride, DJ Dahi, Steve Lacy, you know, Danielle. And yet I still think there's a continuity. And I also just feel like I don't know, now it just feels very obvious to me how the albums and the live show all work together. And it's kind of like there's just so many ways of looking at the band. There's me as a songwriter. There's me, CT, and Bayo as the original members. There's me and Ariel and our unique relationship. There's me, CT, Ariel, and Bayo, and what the four of us are like when we're together. There's Will and Garrett and Colin and Ray are playing with us live now. You know, there's... And somehow it all feels... it feels very right that it all falls under the umbrella of Vampire Weekend. And sometimes, especially when we're doing like Vampire Campfire and we're just kind of doing what we normally do, but filming it, just the three of us hanging out, I've often thought too about like, it's funny, I am very independently minded as a songwriter, and yet I'm just like not a solo artist. I'll have to reflect on why I feel that way so much, but there's something about like when we're hanging out, and I don't know, I love being able to bounce ideas. To be able to bounce ideas off of Ariel and the other guys, and that's what feels right to me. You know, and I guess it's kind of like in any type of relationship. If you can find that middle ground where you have all the independence you need, but there still is some of those ties that bind, you know, there is a sweet spot. Like everybody's going to define it differently, but I feel like we all know what it is, right? Whether it's a romantic relationship or family relationship, you know when it's not right. But you know, if you can find that middle ground, you really appreciate having the independence and the connection. Unlimited independence gives you zero connection. Too much connection gives you zero independence. So you know what I mean? It's that middle ground. And I've definitely felt a lot of happiness and gratitude for like that can exist in Vampire Weekend. Because like, of course, history is littered with many organizations that could not happily find that middle ground. And my hope is that when we're on our 8th or 9th or 10th album, which, you know, by at the rate we go would be a long time from now, that people would look back and say, whatever their favorite era was, they're always going to be people who's like, I like the early stuff. Of course, you know, I'm a music fan too. I feel that way about certain bands. There's people who got in on different albums. But what I do hope is that people can see a type of coherence and that it kind of makes some type of sense. That's the most anybody can hope for. Even a solo artist, that's the most you can hope for, let alone a band that has twists and turns.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said earlier, I think it's awesome. It does feel like now, and with Father of the Bride as well, like leaning into that, making a whole universe, a whole Vampire Weekend universe, and, you know, the fact that you do Time Crisis and have that as like, you know, sort of people know the language of that show. It just, you know, making a newsletter and doing all of these things, it's like, that's an awesome kind of group to follow. You know, it's like its own whole world. There's no, the rules of the rest of the world don't apply to it. It's its own universe. And it's like, oh, here in the Vampire Weekend universe, this, all of this trippy stuff makes sense, you know?
Totally. And it's nice to have camaraderie be a part of the story. You know, it's just something you don't think about that much when you're in your 20s and you're kind of like, everybody's trying to feel out, who am I supposed to be? And people are pushing off against each other, and people can be competitive and ambitious. It's all normal stuff. But when I think about what's meaningful about the band concept in 2024, I do think camaraderie is part of it. And again, I just feel like for me, I wouldn't know exactly what to do with myself. It's just like a pure solo artist. I like that in Vampire Weekend, you can have, there's times I can really stand out and be like, this is my voice and my perspective. And there's times it can be diffused in something else. So it's as I can see why it's why for some people it's being in a band might feel like a trap or a cage, and not everybody, it's not right for everybody. But yeah, for me, yeah, I'm so glad to have that extended world. And you talk about Time Chris, I guess really all we're saying is it's nice to have friends. It's a cold world. gotta have friends. There's a loneliness epidemic too. We've probably all gotten a taste of it one way or another. Gotta have friends.
Get a couple of crews going and then make those crews overlap, and your crew just gets bigger.
You need two or three crews, have them overlap. That's about it. You don't need 10 crews. That's weird. But you need two or three crews, somewhat like-minded, couple group chats, just have, you know, some reason to pick up your phone every now and then. Yeah, that's all you need.
Thank you so much for getting together to do this.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Ezra for that interview and for the music, which has been so important to me. VampireWeekend.com to see everywhere they're headed. And they've got a lot of upcoming dates around the world this year. And that brings us to the end of episode 105. I'm excited to share an interview with Ty Siegel in a couple of weeks. You can find other episodes at jennylsq.com, and you can reach me on socials at jennylsq. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.